Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Attorney Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who examines the significance of Bush administration memos authorizing the abuse and torture of detainees held in U.S.-run prisons in Iraq and elsewhere. John Lugo of Columbia Action, who discusses the investigation into the murder of thousands of Patriotic Union Party members in Columbia 20 years ago. And Njoki Jehu, director of the 50 Years is Enough Network, who takes a critical look at the recently concluded G8 summit meeting of the world's wealthiest nations who gathered at Sea Island, Georgia last week. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Two years ago, conservative Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee set their sights on federal judge James Rosenbaum, a Reagan appointee, for questioning harsh drug sentences. The Minnesota federal judge had testified in May 2002 in favor of a proposal by the U.S. Sentencing Commission to reduce mandatory drug sentences for low-level offenders. The GOP majority took offense and started to investigate Judge Rosenbaum. According to The Nation magazine, a few months earlier, a House subcommittee produced a 22-page report full of allegations against the Republican judge. Democratic Congressman Robert Scott, a member of the Judiciary Committee, charged he didn't see how anyone could interpret it as anything other than an attempt to intimidate someone who dissents from the GOP party line. The House subcommittee also tried to get the General Accounting Office, an arm of Congress, to investigate Rosenbaum's sentencing history. But the GAO balked. Instead, the investigative agency studied federal drug sentencing nationwide, using the 8th Federal District, that includes Minnesota, as a model. Meanwhile, House Republicans, with the help of Majority Leader Tom DeLay, successfully tacked an amendment to a bill, making it much harder for any federal judge to divert from the guidelines set by the U.S. Sentencing Commission. Growing up on a vegetarian diet in Florida, Ty Michael Schmidt never had a cold or ear infection before he was 5 years old. Then doctors found a tumor in his abdomen. His mother and several scientists blamed the tumor on a nearby nuclear plant. Ty's mother, Andrea Schmidt, told E!, the environmental magazine, 50 area kids had been diagnosed with cancer. Yet the St. Lucie County Health Department denied there was a cancer cluster near the St. Lucie nuclear plant. However, a study by the Florida Health Department detected a significant increase in childhood brain cancer and disorders in the central nervous system. Health officials made tests on 561 chemical and potential contaminants, but they failed to test for strontium-90, a radioactive byproduct of nuclear fission. The New York-based Radiation and Public Health Project found a marked increase in St. Lucie County of children under 10 contracting cancer. The county experienced a 40% increase in childhood cancer, more than four times the national average. Still, the nuclear utility company, Florida Light and Power, denies it releases dangerous amounts of strontium-90 into the atmosphere. As Steve Lester of the Activist Center for Health, Environment, and Justice explained, "These plants are releasing small quantities of low-level radiation every day. The amount may seem insignificant, but when you look at 50 cities, you can see slowly that it has quite an impact." Brian Williamson, Jamaica's best-known gay rights activist, was found stabbed to death lying in a pool of blood in his Kingston apartment in early June. The J-Flag gay rights group that Williamson founded called the murder a hate crime, but the local police are classifying the incident as a robbery, noting that the flat was ransacked and a money safe was missing. J-Flag counters that Williamson's visibility as a gay man leads them to suspect this was a hate crime. According to the BBC, male homosexuality is illegal in Jamaica, and the island nation has gained a reputation for breeding homophobia, where popular songs often advocate violence against gays. Since 1997, 30 gay men have been reportedly killed in Jamaica. Through his activism, Williamson was one of the first Jamaicans to publicly denounce discrimination against gays and people with HIV and AIDS. J-Flag volunteer Tony Ron remembers Williamson as being very courageous and who would never stop to think, "Oh, I might get into trouble over this." So, in a sense, he was very selfless. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
As the investigation into the torture and sexual humiliation of Iraqi detainees held at Abu Ghraib and other U.S.-run prisons continues, a series of memos have been disclosed which reveal that the Justice Department and White House lawyers had in essence authorized such abuse. A January 2002 Justice Department memo argues that U.S. officials could not be charged with war crimes for the abuse of prisoners because the Geneva Conventions did not apply to detainees held in the war in Afghanistan. The Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel wrote a memo in August 2002 which concluded that certain acts may be cruel, inhuman, or degrading, but still not produce pain and suffering of the requisite intensity to fall within a ban on torture defined in international treaties and U.S. law. Another memo, written in March 2003 by the Department of Defense, asserted that as Commander-in-Chief, President Bush was not bound by any international treaties barring torture or by a U.S. federal anti-torture law. In addition to seven American soldiers charged with abusing detainees, four British troops will now be tried in a military court on allegations that they assaulted Iraqi prisoners and forced them to engage in sexual acts. As the U.S. prepares for the June 30th symbolic transition to Iraqi sovereignty under a new interim government, violence has surged, raising the death toll of American and coalition troops, private contractors, and Iraqi police. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses the significance of the Bush administration's memos on torture and summarizes a lawsuit his group has brought against two private security companies accused of torturing Iraqi prisoners in order to secure more Pentagon contracts.
These were really shocking. I mean, just utterly shocking to me. Actually, the first one that was released came out in a Wall Street Journal article, Jess Braven piece, and it's actually one the center helped get released. It was a March 2003 memo from a working group on interrogations, and it was sort of summarized a lot of the subsequent memos that have come out, because memos came from the Office of Legal Counsel of Justice, from various branch agencies in the military, and these had to do particularly with the president and the prohibition against torture. And what was really stunning to people was there were sections of that memo that said that the president, as the commander-in-chief in fighting a war, had the right to ignore the prohibitions against torture that were contained in the Torture Convention and contained in the United States criminal law. U.S. criminal law specifically forbids torture carried outside the United States. And this memo said that the president could ignore that prohibition. The memo went on to say, and to redefine really what torture meant, so that it became so severe that most of the conduct that we've been reading about under this new definition would arguably not come within it. So it was really a double-barreled defense and an attempt really to give the president the authority to ask people to, in my view, torture people that were in Iraq in particular, possibly in Guantanamo as well. Since that memo came out 2 weeks ago, we've had a series of other shoes drop, as it were. Now memos are leaking out of everywhere, which is fantastic. Really, the backup for this, I read the one last night from the Office of Legal Counsel of Department of Justice, and that's, you know, should be one of the most serious and impressive pieces of legal writing you get. And it sort of hewed the same line that the president and his commander-in-chief powers could violate prohibitions against torture. So there's that whole series of memos. Then there's another series of memos that went from the president's counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, to the president, conceivably, or others. And those came out even a little earlier. When it was stunning about the Gonzalez memo was really addressed particularly the people in Guantanamo. And it said, you know, you have a right not to apply the conventions to the people in Guantanamo. Now, what right the president has to decide whether conventions apply or not is something I'm not clear on. The conventions, by their terms, tell who they apply to. That's the first problem. The implication really of the memo is, look, there's a war crime statute in the United States. There's a criminal statute. That prohibits violations of the Geneva Conventions, what are called grave breaches. That requires that prisoners be treated humanely, not simply that they can't be tortured, but they be treated humanely. And what Gonzalez was saying, essentially to the president, it appears, was, look, if we say the Geneva Conventions don't apply, then we can argue the war crime statute doesn't apply, and then no one can prosecute us for what we're doing in Guantanamo. That's essentially what this memo says. So you put those two sets of memos together, you have an administration here that has set us back 1,000 years, that when and if we ever get out of this dark cave we're in, it's going to take us a long, long time to repair the damage.
Michael Ratner, it seems that the Justice Department attorneys, as well as those working for the White House, took great pains to make the distinction between inflicting pain on a prisoner and actual quote-unquote torture. A legalistic detail here, or what? How do you describe what they were trying to do?
I mean, they're trying to find every defense they can for essentially torturing people but not calling it torture. So when a guy sits down, an interrogator or whoever it is who's doing the abuse or torture, the Justice Department view is that he has to have in his mind the specific intent to cause severe pain. If severe pain results, that's not enough. To read those justifications that you can treat human beings like this is to lower the dignity, really, of not just the torturer, but of all of us.
Michael Ratner, those who defend the White House and deflect the allegations of torture often talk about scenarios where a ticking time bomb is out someplace and torture has to be employed to get information to save dozens, hundreds, or thousands of lives. You know, so there is a torture lobby out there. People like Alan Dershowitz, famous attorney, who go on a lot of these TV talk shows and say, the times we're living in, the threat of terrorism, sometimes there's a justification for torture. What do you say?
The ticking time bomb hypothetical, which is always raised, is an occasion that never really occurs, and it certainly hasn't occurred yet. And that the idea that you somehow make pitch your argument on that is nonsensical to me. Secondly, I don't believe you should ever use torture. I think it demeans the torturer, it demeans our society, and it demeans human dignity. And once you open the door to the so-called one case, you're going to open the door to everyone being tortured. And that's really what's happened, essentially. You know, they now torture people, apparently, routinely in Iraq. I find it to be unspeakable that there's people out there in what you call the torture lobby. It is just unspeakable to me that the minute the U.S. had a terrorist attack, it immediately sunk really into a primitive stage of civilization, as if, not civilization, a primitive age of society, when all of these laws were not there, when the hundreds of years we spent building these up. I mean, we're talking about grand inquisitors. That's what we're talking about when we say you can be tortured. So there's a lot of reasons to be against torture. The main one to me, the absolute main one, is we're human beings. And hopefully we've learned something in our couple of thousand or 5,000 years that we've been trying to establish a just society.
Michael Ratner, I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about the lawsuit that your organization, the Center for Constitutional Rights, has brought against two private security firms working in Iraq, Titan and CACI International. There's allegations that these private contractors abused and tortured Iraqi prisoners in order to secure more Pentagon contracts. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, we did bring a lawsuit last week against two of the private contractors and three people who worked for them at various times. And it's based on primarily allegations that were in the Taguba report. In that report, private contractors were named as condoning or being involved in some way in those abuses. And we have a number of plaintiffs in that case who were harmed pretty badly, a number of them tortured, electrodes to the tongue, etc. You know, we don't know for sure who did everything to them. We do know that private contractors, or we allege in the lawsuit that private contractors were involved in some kinds of abuses in the Iraqi prison. And that is one of the reasons that we brought this lawsuit, to really to bring that out.
That was Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Call the center at area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at www.ccr-ny.org. Michael Ratner is the author of Guantanamo, What the World Should Know, published by Chelsea Green. The nation of Colombia has suffered through one of the world's longest-running civil wars, which has seen over 40,000 dead and millions displaced over the past 40 years. On Tuesday, June 15th, 34 workers were massacred on a remote ranch in La Guevara, 300 miles northeast of Bogota. The mayor of the town says it appears to be the work of FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the country's largest guerrilla group. Almost 20 years ago, thousands of members of Colombia's Progressive Patriotic Union Party, or UP, were systematically killed by forces connected with the government. 12 years ago, the head of a Colombian human rights group, Reiniciar, which means to start again, began investigating the murders. The case is now being reviewed by the Human Rights Office of the Organization of American States in Washington, D.C. The commissioners have recently affirmed that there is sufficient evidence to bring a charge of genocide against the Colombian state. John Lugo was a student organizer in Colombia during the 1980s who joined the UP. Soon after becoming active with the party, he was arrested by the government. He was later released, but received repeated death threats and fled to the U.S. Lugo now lives in Connecticut, where he remains active in the struggle to bring peace and justice to Colombia. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with John Lugo about the origin of the Patriotic Union Party, its platform, and what human rights activists hope they will achieve in their efforts to hold government officials accountable for the thousands of UP members murdered.
Everything started in 1985 when the guerrillas of FARC and the government, they were having a peace talks. And one of the agreements is to give the guerrillas an opportunity to create a political party, which was created, and the name was UP, Patriotic Union. You know, from the beginning, you know, when the party was conformed, they start killing members and the leadership of the group.
The government, you mean?
The government, paramilitaries, and drug lords. We participated in elections in 1986, and we won, like, many aldermanic chambers, and we elect, you know, three people to the Senate of Colombia and to the Congress also. But then that was like a death sentence for us. For the next like 10 years, 2,000 people die. So we lost our first president candidate. He got killed in 1988. And then the second candidate, you know, was killed also. 12 years ago, this woman, Jael Quiroga from Reiniciar, she started doing a research on, you know, on many cases, you know, and start interviewing families. She do research on 1,200 cases. Then she figured out, like many of these cases, the families claim the government. And when we talk about government, we talk about like the secret police, the police, and the army. They were involved in the killing of their family members. So with that research, he took the case to the Inter-American Office of Human Rights at the Organization of American States, OAS. She took the case there, and the government, they agreed that in some part they were responsible for the killing of all these people. And right now they are in the process of like a friendly negotiation, because they know if they go to a trial, the government is going to lose the case. So they prefer to settle the case outside of the Inter-American Office of Human Rights.
Would that involve money, or what would if they settled, what would the people or the families of the murdered people get?
They get an apology from the Colombian government, because the Colombian government say in some way we're responsible for the killing of all those people. And secondly, it's going to be a monetary compensation to the families.
What did the UP stand for? What were their principles, or what were their positions on different issues?
Okay, the UP is a third political party. Colombian political scene has been dominated by two main groups, the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party. And basically, they represent the richest peoples in Colombia. So what UP stands for is a party for the poor people of the Colombians, with an agenda where claims, you know, for land reform, you know, and fighting for the rights of the poor people in Colombia. But one of the things we had to remember is like everybody who become members of the UP in, you know, back in 1985 or 1986, there was not just guerrilla members, as many people claim, you know. People who joined the party was like people from many, many, many different sectors, you know. There were people from the Liberal Party, even people from the Conservative Party. People who were involved in the unions, people who did not have any connections with the guerrillas. That's the reason that the government was afraid about this new phenomenon, UP 1985, 1986, because many people, in just 1 year, a party who just was created in a peace talks between the Colombian government and the guerrillas, Then they become this massive movement of people in Colombia. And after the guerrillas and the government, they broke their negotiations, the party keep going independently from the FARC. So we can say there was not really any connections between both groups. But the government and many of the people who, of the groups that they were involved for the killing of the membership, they justify those killings because they say, oh, UPS is the political arm of the guerrillas of Colombia.
That was John Lugo of Columbia Action Connecticut, who is also a producer at WPKN Radio. To support the group's efforts or to get more information, contact them at ColumbiaActionCT@hotmail.com. Additional information on the human rights situation in Colombia can be found at www.columbiajournal.org. Heads of state representing the world's wealthiest nations, the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Canada, Russia, and Japan, or Group of Eight, convened on Sea Island, Georgia for their annual gathering. There, with the protection of thousands of federal, state, and local police, the leaders dealt with issues related to the U.S. occupation of Iraq, including a vain request from President Bush for NATO to send troops to Iraq or assist in the training of Iraqi soldiers. The G8 leaders also discussed a range of other issues, which included issuing an endorsement of a plan to encourage international cooperation to develop an AIDS vaccine, working to combat famine across the developing world, and a commitment to deploy more peacekeeping forces to quell conflicts in Africa. But despite press reports that the G8 would sign on to a plan put forward by British Prime Minister Tony Blair to cancel the debt of the world's most impoverished nations, the leaders opted only to extend by 2 years an existing initiative to reduce those debts. Protesters who have in recent years staged large demonstrations opposing the policies of the G8, the World Trade Organization, World Bank, and International Monetary Fund were hard to find in Georgia due in part to the remoteness of the summit site and an extremely heavy police presence. But members of non-governmental organizations who have worked hard in recent years to promote debt cancellation were at the summit to pronounce the G8's failure to dump the debt as a tragedy that will cost many lives. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Njoki Jehu, director of the 50 Years is Enough Network, who explains why an initiative to cancel 100% of the debt for the world's poorest countries is crucial to saving the lives of millions.
They got to have some great photo opportunities, having invited a group of leaders from the Middle East and a group of leaders from Africa. And needless to say, the issues that were very critical in terms of being resolved on the African continent, the issue of international debt, was given a cursory sort of referencing that they would continue with the HIPIC initiative, which has failed to address the question of international debt definitively. And then on the question of the HIV/AIDS pandemic, of course, instead of talking about fully funding the Global Fund to fight HIV/AIDS, TB, and malaria, all they talked about was beginning working on an HIV/AIDS vaccine, which is needed, but again, which condemns millions of people to death and to lack of treatment. So it was quite a disappointing summit in terms of the outcome, especially given rumors early last week that they were considering 100% debt cancellation.
The G8 nations refused to support 100% multilateral debt cancellation for impoverished nations, but instead put forward the idea of a 2-year extension of the HIPIC Countries Initiative, standing for Heavily Indebted Poor Countries Initiative. Tell us what that is, please, and the import or lack of import of that initiative.
Well, the initiative was the response of the creditor nations and the creditor institutions, the IMF and World Bank, back in 1996, after years and years of saying they couldn't officially do debt relief because it was against their charter. They saw the writing on the wall in terms of the forthcoming and upcoming International Jubilee Movement for Debt Cancellation. And it was a preemptive action on their part. They decided that the thing to do was to offer a little bit of debt relief with all kinds of conditionality and all kinds of bureaucratic and technocratic maneuvers that they were making, so that, in fact, they ended up with a category of countries that are called the heavily indebted poor countries. But, you know, as your listeners may recall, countries like Haiti were not included. Countries like Jamaica, Malawi, Bangladesh, Nigeria were not included. Clearly countries that needed debt cancellation as much as any of the countries that were on that initial list. And this is one of the shortcomings of the HIPC initiative. It deals with too few countries. It has too many conditions. It's about continuing to impose structural adjustment programs, currency devaluation, privatization, deregulation, focusing on export rather than production for sustainability within a country.
Jyoti, who would pay this debt off? The G8 industrialized nations, the World Bank and IMF basically say, oh, well, we can't forgive the debt 100% because it would be against our charter. How have you at 50 Years is Enough Network and groups like Jubilee USA Network, how have you proposed that this get accomplished?
It's not a mystery about how debts get canceled. It happens all the time. They are not, right now, discussing Iraq's debt and arguing that it's odious, that it was borrowed by a brutal and repressive dictator, Saddam Hussein. And part of what we argue is that that case can also be made about the apartheid debt, about the debt of Abacha in Nigeria, Mobutu in Zaire, Marcos in the Philippines, Somoza in Nicaragua, Suharto in Indonesia, and the list is quite long. So the UN has said that Africa is spending about $15 billion a year in servicing debt, whereas there is a $10 billion sort of shortfall, if you will, in sub-Saharan Africa to fight the HIV/AIDS pandemic. So this is what we are talking about. And the UN has said that in Africa alone, 19,000 children are dying every day because of a combination of lack of nutrition, lack of immunization, lack of access to safe water, et cetera, et cetera. It is a crisis. It's a moral outrage. And I think that history will judge all of us if we are not on the front lines calling for this debt to be cancelled. And so the Jubilee Act is something that people should be calling their members of Congress and telling them about it and really arguing for the case, for justice to be done, for Jubilee to be granted, and for those relationships to be made right.
That was Njoki Jehu, director of the 50 Years is Enough Network. Contact the network by calling area code 202-IMF-BANK or visit their website at www.50years.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.